Glenn Beck.
One of my favorite quotes came yesterday. Quote, the son of God himself wouldn't approve, end quote. That is from a writer of Newsweek. Apparently, she picked up the phone. She talked to Jesus about his opinion on Trump's new Christmas-themed Make America Great Again hats. She's convinced that Jesus would not approve of the holiday merchandise. Well, I don't know. I really don't know. I know the hats cost $45. That's nearly double the price of the traditional Trump hat, but it's a special hat, you know. What would Jesus do about President Donald Trump's overpriced Christmas hats? I don't know. I don't have the bracelet. That's what she's asking. Then she goes on to cite several verses from scripture denouncing greed and 1 Corinthians, you know, saying that you shouldn't cover your head while praying. Okay, all right. If the article was supposed to be satire, it should also be funny. But I think it was serious. So, Newsweek, help me out on this one. Would Jesus approve of your promoting your membership options immediately following that article? Because on that article, you know, just like Trump, you used Christmas to sell your products. Newsweek literally had an ad that says, give the perfect Christmas gift. A magazine subscription makes a fantastic gift that lasts an entire year. Would Jesus approve of that? Come on. How much for the cheapest subscription to Newsweek? Only $1.90 a week, which comes out to $99 a year, more than twice the price of the Trump hat, which I can wear for 5 years if I wanted. Hayes maybe should have looked up Matthew 7:5 while she was reading scripture and removed the beam from her own eye before writing this nonsense. But the bottom line is, selling products, whether it's a subscription to Newsweek or a Trump hat, to consumers so they can give their loved ones a present on Christmas is a good thing. It's a good thing. Christmas is not about the presents. But, you know, at the root of purchasing and giving gifts, it is a symbolic gesture of love. And I think it would be a gesture that I would believe that Jesus would be okay with.
It's Thursday, November 30th. This is the Glenn Beck Program.
I've done broadcasts for 40-some years, and I think this is the only time I've ever liked the FCC chairman, Ajit Pai. Welcome to the program, Ajit. How are you?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on and for the kind words.
Well, you didn't have a high bar. I do not like regulation at all. And that's what the FCC has done. And they have gotten stronger and stronger. And I worry about the internet. And then you come in and you are now having a real problem because people are you're going to repeal net neutrality and people are coming out and I'm sorry for what your family went through, picketing your house on Thanksgiving weekend.
It's outrageous, and you know, some of the online threats have been even more outrageous. And you know, I think for anybody in public office, in any publicly exposed position, you should not be threatened. Your family should not be threatened with, you know, violence or the like, simply because of the position you hold. And you know, just simply steals my resolve to keep doing what I think is the right thing to do, and to also to keep my family safe.
So, Ajit, first of all, I'm sorry for this, but this is what's happening all over the country to anybody. When people disagree with somebody, we just all of a sudden we think it's okay to harass them or terrorize them or offer death threats or whatever online. Does the FCC have any place in regulating that kind of speech online or anywhere else?
We don't. I mean, obviously, if it threatens violence or the like, we can work with law enforcement authorities. But by and large, we have a hands-off role. We don't regulate the content that goes over the internet. What I will say, though, is that I have tried to speak out about the fact that we need to have a more civil, fact-focused discourse in this country. It's one thing to disagree on policy, but if you go out there peddling misinformation, like democracy is threatened, the internet is about to be broken, and here's the guy who's doing it, here's his phone number, here's where where he lives. Here is his family. You shouldn't be surprised when people get alarmed and start to take outrageous actions. And so I would hope that we try to focus on the facts, as passionate as people are about this issue.
So they are claiming that this is the end of democracy on the internet because you are going to repeal something that Obama put in, net neutrality.
And that's the great irony about this. All we are proposing to do is to go back to President Clinton's light-touch, market-based framework that was in place from 1996 to 2015. It's a regulatory system that has been proven to work. That's why we have the internet economy that's the envy of the world. And so all of these apocalyptic predictions are simply ridiculous, given the fact that we lived under these exact same rules for two decades, and the world didn't end. To the contrary, it thrived, especially for conservatives who have historically been marginalized when it comes to having the ability to express themselves.
Yeah, it's amazing that they would think that the era of 1996 to 2015 was a bad one for the internet. I mean, it changed our worlds completely.
It's incredible. All these people suggesting that we were living in some digital dystopia before 2015, and that's why the government had to seize control of the internet, are completely misinterpreting history, and I think are oblivious to the fact that these regulations do have costs. And going forward, we want to make sure that we have rules that accurately reflect the market and promote free speech and expression online as well.
So I talked to Ray Kurzweil, who is the head of the Singularity University and consultant for Google and everybody else. And we talked about this at one point, kind of half jokingly, about, you know, if Google can monitor all of the stuff and see what people are searching for, if somebody is searching for a better way to make a better Google, why would Google ever allow them to do that? Are you concerned at all about the rise of these gigantic corporations that are bigger than some countries in their power? Like Google. I mean, Google pretty much wrote the net neutrality bill.
This is a growing concern, I think, in some halls in Washington and around the country. And part of the argument I made earlier this week is that you should practice what you preach. If you come to the FCC saying we need these heavy-handed regulations to be applied to one part of the internet economy, but, oh, don't regulate me, you should be consistent in how you operate your business. And that's part of the reason why I've said that we need to have a level playing field. Everyone should play by the same rules, and the government certainly shouldn't be picking winners and losers and dispensing regulatory favors to those companies or parts of the industry that it favors at any given point in time.
So how does net neutrality benefit a company like Google and hurt the small guy?
Well, I think the primary way is it's essentially saying that if you're an online content provider, you get rules of the road that are going to favor you, that you essentially have the ability to pursue your business model without regulation, but the companies that run the networks that have to invest in those networks aren't free to essentially build out their networks and manage them appropriately. And so that's pretty useful to companies that are sending and receiving a lot of traffic on the internet. And my simple point is let the market decide how this works, instead of having the government micromanage it and pick winners and losers.
Ajit, we were talking to Ajit Pai from the FCC, and I know that a lot of, even some conservatives that I talk to, see net neutrality as something that's positive because they look at the way they use the internet. They stream Netflix, and Netflix is awesome. Everybody loves Netflix. It's great programming, and I don't want some company telling me that I can't get the speeds I need, so I get buffering and everything else. We need to stop that. What do you tell those people?
I tell them two things. First of all, I understand where they're coming from. I love Netflix as well and stream a video all the time. The problem is twofold. Number one, the companies that are building the networks have to be able to have a wide enough road, so to speak, to carry all of this bandwidth. And that road, expanding it, maintaining it, costs a lot of money. And so the question is, should we allow commercial arrangements where the companies that are occupying a lot of space on the road will share in the cost of maintaining that road? And that's one of the things that the market has traditionally been able to sort out. My point is simply we shouldn't have the government dictating up front that, look, we're going to set the rules of the road and you prefer one part of the industry over another.
Can you explain, because people say that by repealing this, it's going to make it harder for poor Americans to afford the internet, which is usually the opposite of what happens when government doesn't get involved. When government doesn't get involved, the prices go down because there's competition. When the government starts regulating, the prices usually go up. Can you help solve this?
Absolutely, and this is one of the classic bits of misinformation out there. These regulations, these heavy-handed regulations on some of these network operators have actually led them to reduce their investment in building these high-speed networks, especially in rural and low-income urban areas. You know, building these networks is hard. It costs a lot of money, takes a lot of time. And what I've heard from myself firsthand when I've gone to places like Spencer, Iowa, and Parsons, Kansas, and Reno, Nevada, is that some of these smaller companies, the very companies that are necessary to promote more competition and to reach rural and low-income consumers, they are the ones who are suffering under these regulations. They've told us on the record that they are holding back on investment, or they can't even raise capital in the first place because companies say there's not going to be a return on the investment because of these rules. And so the argument I've made is that poorer consumers in particular are worse off because these regulations are standing in the way of them getting internet access or getting more competition.
I think there's a strong ideological argument to me that there's no human right, there's no constitutional right to Netflix. That is not what the government should be involved in when it comes to commerce. But people, you know, they obviously like it. They don't want these things to happen. And when you have a situation where a company could, in theory, strangle a particular site's bandwidth, people get panicked. However, is it a real-world thing? My understanding is it basically never happens, and if it does, the result afterwards is actually a positive one.
Exactly, and this is part of the reason why, going back to your earlier question about Netflix, and this is exactly the reason why we should let the Federal Trade Commission, not the FCC, figure out whether or not there are any of these arrangements that are anti-competitive. That kind of phenomenon that you were just describing doesn't happen in the marketplace today, and if it did, one could imagine that it could be pro-competitive or it could be anti-competitive. My point is simply the FCC shouldn't preemptively say for all of the 4,000-some internet service providers and for the rest of time, we know what the market is going to be, and we're going to forbid this or that business practice. Let's let the anti-competitive authorities, the competition authorities at the Federal Trade Commission, figure out what could be anti-competitive on a case-by-case basis. That's a much better way of singling out the bad apples, I think.
Talking to the chairman of the FCC, Ajit Pai, about net neutrality. Ajit, do you look at all to the regulations of FDR and see how the big, for instance, big three automakers put automakers like, Auburn out of business when they started regulating? I mean, a lot of this stuff, as we are growing into a new area in technology, a lot of this stuff we can learn from the past. Are you examining any of that?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the net neutrality regulations that the previous FCC adopted in 2015 were directly modeled on the rules developed in the Roosevelt administration to handle Ma Bell, the telephone monopoly. And the argument I've made is somewhat counterintuitive to a lot of people, but I think you might appreciate it, which is that these heavy-handed rules from the 1930s that were designed for monopolies actually benefit some of the bigger companies. They're the ones who have the lawyers and the accountants and the lobbyists to comply with these regulations. The smaller companies don't. And so ironically enough, these heavy-handed rules that were designed for a monopoly will end up leading the marketplace toward a monopoly. And that's the last thing we want to see. We want to see more competition, more smaller providers entering the marketplace. And heavy-handed rules are not the way to get us there.
Seeing that you are the chairman of the FCC and so much of freedom of speech in some ways falls under your purview, are you concerned about the direction that, you know, our colleges or our universities or even our media and our politicians seem to be moving in, where there doesn't seem to be any tolerance for different kinds of opinions?
Absolutely. And I just gave a speech about this yesterday, in fact, where I said that there seems to be less of a tolerance for other points of view, and that social media, ironically enough, given the name, seems to be accentuating that problem. And I'm very disturbed about the future of free speech and expression in this country. If I think the harbinger is certainly on college campuses, where you see people not only not wanting to listen to other points of view, they actively want to shut down the expression of other points of view. And this is the generation, these are the people who are going to have to carry the torch for this core constitutional freedom in the years to come. And I've long said that the First Amendment is great. It's nice to have that on the parchment of the Constitution, but it also requires a culture that is willing to defend this principle that we are a pluralistic nation, that other points of view, even if repugnant to you, should be allowed to be expressed. And I do worry that our culture is becoming less and less tolerant of other points of view, and eventually that's going to have a serious impact if it's not corrected.
Ajit Pai, thank you so much. I appreciate it and appreciate your time. Chairman, you bet. Chairman of the FCC.
Glenn Beck.
On November 18th, what, a week ago last Saturday, I was about to take the stage at the M1, Mercury One Gala, and the director of operations of the Nazarene Fund reported that we had just captured our 100th slave and set them free. There were three Yazidi sisters that were 14, 8 years old, and 3 years old, and they had been kidnapped in Syria and were enslaved in Syria and worked as sex slaves. We got them out of Syria and returned them to their family through one of our rescue partners, and we want to thank you for making this possible. That's 100 Christian or Yazidi slaves that we have freed in the last, 18 months. We have a huge goal, and we would like to not only expand and tear the heart out of the slave trade, but we haven't even touched upon the organ selling that is going on in the Middle East right now with the Christians and the Yazidis. If you're, you know, if you won't comply or bow down, you're just good for your organs. And it's horrible what's going on. We are asking if you would help us raise $25 million in the next 12 months so we can go and rescue those people, put an end to the slave trade, not only in Iraq and Syria, but we are also going to be moving into northern Africa and around the world with our new partner, Operation Underground Railroad. You can donate at thenazarenefund.org, become an abolitionist, and donate now at the nazarenefund.org, thenazarenefund.org. So I saw this. I just got this in. This is a painting that has been done. Now, I can't remember his name. Shoot, it's not here either. The art, I can't remember the McNaughton, I think, is the artist's name. And there is a painting now of all of the abolitionists from the past and a painting to the new ones. So you see Abraham Lincoln and all those people on one side.
Yeah.
I was shocked to see, look at my weepy face. You see me? Like towards the front.
I'm looking for Glenn. Oh, is that you? Oh, yeah, yeah.
Isn't that wild?
Yeah, you look... It's like what happens when someone takes the last cupcake out of the room.
I know it is.
It's like, look at it go.
But these are the modern day people who are freeing slaves.
Right.
And it's a great painting of the people of history and the people who are making a difference now, like Tony Robbins and Tim Ballard and Mike Tomlin and Mia Love and Ashton Kutcher. You can find that at ourpainting.org. Ourpainting.org.
Glenn Beck. Glenn Beck program.
Hopefully we'll have Mike Leon with us for a second. He's got a tax proposal that he's working on, and we'll talk to him about it.
There's some ridiculous things going on, arguments against the tax bill, and there are arguments against it, good ones, in that it's not as good as it should be. It's not as bold as it should be. Mike Lee is trying to do some things to it that may help, depending on your perspective. But some of the arguments against it are also unfair. National Review has four of them that they featured today. People are calling it a middle class tax hike. This is an interesting thing because what they're trying to do with this is play with the numbers. Tax Policy Center analysis on the Senate bill reveals that 3/4 of all families would get a tax cut, 12% would see a tax increase, and they are concentrated among the rich. Now, to me, that's annoying because no one should be getting any increase. But the idea that it's a middle-class tax cut, you're seeing that on Facebook, you're seeing that in all mainstream media. The average middle-income family would receive a tax cut of approximately $850 through 2025. Now, what they're doing is they're looking at the year 2027, and they're seeing lots of tax increases in that year. The Senate bill is structured because that to make these middle-class tax cuts expire in 2025. They do this for a dumb budgeting gimmick. The idea is, in 2025, no one's going to say, well, we should raise taxes on the middle class. No one's going to want to take that position, so right. They'll all keep the tax cuts. That's risky. I don't like it. But even if you say that they don't extend them, what you would have is a $7,000 tax cut in the early years, followed by a $100 annual tax increase later.
I'll take it.
It's still a big cut over the time. Yeah. They're just focusing on the 2027.
But nobody's going to do it at that time anyway. Mike Lee is with us. Senator Mike Lee, how are you, sir?
Doing great, Glenn. It's good to be with you.
Can you help us make sense in heads or tails of the tax plan and tell us what's going to happen? And I want to talk about you and Rubio have gotten together, and you're asking exactly what?
We're asking to make the child tax credit more meaningful to everyone who works, everyone who pays taxes. What we want is a tax credit people can take advantage of up to 15.3% of their earnings. And this is a tax, the payroll tax is something that almost every American worker pays. And our tax system fails to take into account what we call the parent tax penalty. Our child tax credit proposal would address that. Now, and I've been accused justifiably in the past of being really boring on your show. Talking about this proposal subjects me to that accusation. So
we're gonna let you go. I mean, it's just that you get turned on by numbers and clauses in the Constitution that most people don't.
We all?
Yeah, sure. Well, no, we don't. But I appreciate that in a senator.
Well, thank you, and I appreciate the chance to talk about it because it really is important. Look, America's working moms and dads contribute to our senior entitlement programs, Social Security and Medicare, twice. Once is they pay their taxes, and the second time is they incur the cost of child rearing. Because of the pay-as-you-go nature of Social Security and Medicare, our working parents are contributing to Social Security and Medicare twice. By increasing the child tax credit and making it refundable up to 15.3% of earnings, what we're doing is we're making sure that we provide necessary tax relief to offset this parent tax penalty.
Mike, is this going to pass?
Yes, and we're going to make sure. Look, it's going to pass because it has to pass. And I'm not sure exactly what form the tax bill will take, but it's going to pass. And I and my Republican colleagues in the Senate are going to make sure of it.
Mike, they were talking about potentially as an offset to an increased child tax credit of having to increase the proposed corporate tax. So it was 20%. They're talking about 22%. Is that going to be necessary to do the changes you're talking about?
This is one way to pay for it. We are not necessarily wedded to that method of paying for it. We're open to other suggestions. I'd love to leave the corporate rate at 20% rather than 22. But as of right now, we got to keep in mind that as President Trump himself explained to us at lunch the other day, 70% of the tax relief in this bill is for corporations, leaving 30% of the relief for individuals. This is one way of shifting more of that relief to individuals, especially to America's most important entrepreneurial class of investors, that is America's parents.
Do you believe that America's corporations feel comfortable enough in investing that money in capital expenditures or investment in employees, or are they just going to roll those tax savings into the market?
Oh, I think they're going to invest in a lot of things that will create jobs, and that's why I'm pleased to offer corporate tax relief. The corporate tax is itself kind of a devious thing because it disguises some of the costs of government. People think taxes on corporations don't cost workers any money. They do. In fact, According to some economists, it may well be that, that half or so of corporate taxes end up coming right out of workers' wages. In any event, we know that when we tax corporations, we chill economic activity and the effects on everyone, including America's middle-class taxpayers.
Is McCain going to stick with you guys? I saw a story yesterday afternoon. It looks like McCain's at it again, I think was the headline. Is McCain...
Yeah, I saw that story, too. It gives me nightmares. Had nightmares ever since that fateful night in July when he left his thumb hanging in suspended animation, leaving us in... We turned the thumb down. I want to make sure that doesn't happen again. I think he'll vote with us at the end of the day. Even if he doesn't, we can lose him and still pass the thing without him.
Mike, I know you. I'm glad you're talking about the payroll tax because I think it's something that conservatives don't get fired up enough about. Here's a tax that is a regressive tax, meaning that people on the poor end of the scale pay more than people on the high end of the income scale, which is something I can't believe any progressive ever defends, but they seem to defend it. And not only it locks us into this this idea, and a lot of conservatives, I think, fall for it, which is these long-term giant programs that are supposedly funded through this, when in reality it kind of all goes into a big pot anyway. These big programs are owed to us because of this separate tax. We don't look at any other giant program the way we look at these entitlement programs, and I think it's a real problem. Is there any hope of attacking this payroll tax even more boldly?
Well, I think you made the point well, and this leads to a point I've been meaning to use in my messaging with this, which is the best way to understand the Rubio-Lee Amendment is that it basically provides a tax cut with respect to payroll taxes. And for some of the reasons that you identify, we've got to focus on this more than we do. And just as importantly, a related point is that the people who would benefit most acutely from the Rubio-Lee proposal would be those workers who are perhaps most at risk of falling out of the workforce and choosing instead to go on welfare. You know, parents with young children who are right at the edge economically of whether or not they're going to decide it makes sense to continue working and instead stop and take welfare benefits. We want to keep them in the workforce. We want to give them plenty of opportunity to stay in the workforce so that they can benefit themselves and their families, so they can get promotions and continue to make more and be contributing members. This would help incentivize them to do that and remove some of the incentives for them to just go on welfare instead.
Mike, I want to switch gears with you and then I'll let you go. You know, Matt Lauer was just let go. Garrison Keillor was just let go. It's a little disturbing to me, A, that we're letting people go without any kind of real due process. It seems like this could get out of hand quickly if we're not really careful. I mean, I'm glad bad guys are going away and I want this to be solved, but it concerns me that there's no due process here. However, the only ones that don't seem really affected by it are those in politics, you know, on the Republican side, Roy Moore and Donald Trump. On the liberal side, it's John Conyer and Al Franken. They're not going anywhere. Does that concern you, Mike?
Yeah, in politics, some things operate differently. Quite tragically, reminding us of the meaning of the word politics. Break it down to its Greek roots: the poly, which means many, and ticks, which are blood-sucking parasites. A lot of what happens here. Look, as to your first point about due process. In the case of Matt Lauer, for instance, look, he was fired by a private for-profit corporation. I assume he was an at-will employee, or if he wasn't an at-will employee, that he had some kind of provision in his contract his employer to take this act. He did this. So speaking literally in constitutional terms, that means there isn't a due process issue. Due process in the lowercase sense of the word, I assume that NBC, being well represented by capable attorneys, made sure that they dotted their I's and crossed their T's and that they made sure that the facts were adequately substantiated before taking this step. Firing someone who holds public office is a little bit different because normally, in most circumstances, to fire them, you have to wait until the next election. But I suspect that there are going to be a whole lot of people getting fired by their voters as these things continue to come out.
You believe that there's more to come out, Mike? You've been there for a while.
Sadly, I come to suspect that there are. I've been saddened and surprised by some of the horrible things that have been happening. And they seem to arise in circumstances where, men will do really bad things in circumstances where they think they can get away with it. There aren't enough reasons that they see not to do it. And it's tragic. It should not be that way. Which makes the top echelon of news entertainment, of media entertainment, and government and politics.
And it makes me a little nervous that if the people don't vote those people out, if they decide that it doesn't matter, we're going to end up with some of the worst people in the world, even worse than we have now in Washington, showing up, because you'll literally be able to get away with anything.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that would be an absolutely unacceptable outcome. Fortunately, Glenn, I don't think that'll happen for two independent reasons. First, I think a lot of people are going to take themselves out of contention, perhaps most or all those people who are in government right now who are subject to these accusations are going to decide it's time to hang it up. Secondly, I really don't think their voters are going to put up with it. This is unacceptable. They shouldn't elect people who will do awful things like this.
Senator Mike Lee, thank you very much. Good luck.
Glenn Beck.
So glad you've tuned in today. For those of you who had Glenn's voice would be gone by the first hour, you're about to lose even if you said the second hour. I don't know if it'll last three, but we'll give it a shot.
Nice work so far.
Yeah, nice work. Thank you. So I'm just reading now. Vanity Fair has just come out with something on Matt Lauer. And this NBC apparently had done a 2-month investigation.
This is what makes you believe that NBC, I mean, they didn't act this fast with Mark Halperin. They didn't act this fast, certainly, with Harvey Weinstein when they had that story in their own company and they gave it to The New Yorker for whatever reason. They took their time on a lot of that stuff. Here, I mean, it was instant. At least that's what they say. I mean, if it's a 2-month investigation, it's hard to imagine that NBC didn't have wind of it before Monday night.
Well, here's what they said. Variety's reporters said that they didn't have to do specific interviews, that Lauer's behavior was an open secret among the employees and the management, and the management went out of its way to ignore his sexual impropriety. I mean, it's not good.
Yeah. Now, Variety is claiming that
there were dozens.
They knew. And NBC had complaints and they fell on deaf ears at NBC from their employees. NBC is saying, we just found out about it yesterday. We swear. And just the fact that how quickly they moved on a guy, they were paying $26 million a year. The Today Show in advertising brings in $508 million a year in revenue.
I'm telling you, you do not get a call at on a Sunday afternoon and say, hey, somebody just filed a sexual harassment suit on Matt Lauer. And by Monday morning, you have decided, okay, because of that one sexual harassment suit, we're gonna put at risk $500 million. There's no way.
Especially
it would be irresponsible for the shareholders to do that.
Yeah, and it would be irresponsible just as a human, right? Like, you shouldn't. These things, that when they come in, and we've heard various levels of this, right? The New York Times reporter who made passes at a couple of women at bars, refuted him, they rejected him, and he didn't do anything to go after them. And it was at a different job in his previous employer. Like, doesn't seem, I mean, look, no, this is much further.
This
than
is
that.
Matt, apparently, with several women dropping his pants and showing them his junk,
which women don't like.
I don't know what guy thinks this is good, but they don't like it, guys. They don't like it.
Glenn Beck.